Today is Thursday, the 5th of August, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Concerns grow in Afghanistan as fighting between government forces and the Taliban continues.
And over the last 2 days, they have been just sort of confined to their homes because most of the city now has fallen to the Taliban.
Plus, authorities in Greece continue battling wildfires.
Water dropping planes, 9 helicopters, and dozens of water cannons have been used to battle the blaze.
We'll have these stories and more next. The Taliban have condemned the United States for offering to relocate Afghans who fear that they may be targeted by the organization once U.S. troops have completed their withdrawal from Afghanistan. The statement comes after the Taliban claimed responsibility for an attack in Kabul on the home of the acting defense minister, as well as another as-yet-unclaimed attack on Wednesday. VOA's Ayaz Ghul joins us from Islamabad with the latest.
Well, the Taliban obviously today claimed responsibility for plotting this suicide car bombing that apparently was targeted at the Afghan defense minister in Kabul. Then there was another blast, but we still have no clarity about that attack. But this one was clearly claimed by the Taliban. And the spokesman for the Taliban issued a statement to media in which he said that this facility that was targeted in Kabul was actually related to the Afghan Defense Ministry and an important meeting, according to the spokesman of Defense Ministry officials, was going on. And they wanted to carry out this attack to, in retaliation for these airstrikes that Afghan Air Force has been conducting in the southern provinces of Helmand and Kandahar, where we have seen one of the worst clashes in recent years, and they are still going on. So it was sort of a revenge attack, according to the Taliban spokesman. But we know that this bombing in Kabul Tuesday night killed at least 8 people and wounded 20 others. And according to Afghan officials, most of them were civilians. But as the Taliban claimed, they were part of the defense ministry. So things are quite volatile, not only in Kabul now, but in other major urban centers, which until now were safe from seeing this kind of insurgent attacks and fighting.
As you mentioned, that intense fighting in the southern areas, especially Helmand province. But what also can you tell us about the fighting that's been taking place in and around Lashkar Gah?
Yes, that's, I think the residents, tens of thousands of residents of Lashkar Gah are in big trouble. In fact, have been in big trouble over the past many, many days. And over the last 2 days, they have been just sort of confined to their homes because most of the city now has fallen to the Taliban. There are a few government administrative buildings and the city airport, which is controlled by the Afghan government. But the rest is with the Taliban. And yesterday evening, like Tuesday evening, there were announcements by the Afghan military urging residents to leave the city, because they were intending to launch a big operation against the Taliban, and that added more problems for the civilians because they have no way to escape the city. So, and ironically, provincial health officials urged the residents of Lashkar Gah to remain inside their homes because they warned them that if they come out, they may be caught in the crossfire. So these poor civilians in the city are really caught in big trouble. They don't know what to do. But the fighting, we know for sure that all day today, there were serious clashes going on inside the city. And in fact, Taliban tried to capture the police headquarters in Lashkar Gah. That attack was going on, but we don't have any latest information about what's happening. But we also know that there is, in the last few hours, intense clashes have also been going on in the northeastern Tahar province, which borders the Central Asian republics of Tajikistan and Turkmenistan. In that area, we are now hearing reports of serious fighting. So it seems that Taliban are really taking the fight to the urban centers in Afghanistan.
One last question. The Taliban came out and criticized the United States for its program to relocate individuals who feel threatened by the Taliban after the U.S. forces leave there through the SIV program and other issues. What can you tell us about what the Taliban said and as far as reaction by those who are seeking refugee status abroad?
Well, obviously, this Taliban statement was quite significant today. You know, they tried to reassure the international community that these Afghan civilians who have served the international forces, including the United States, over the past 20 years will not be, you know, targeted once all international forces leave Afghanistan, and that, you know, they're encouraging, giving them visas and encouraging them to leave the country, as the Taliban statement said, is an interference in Afghanistan's affairs, and that it is going to encourage an exodus of Afghans from the country. And we saw that statement coming at a time when we also have a criticism of this U.S. program, even within Afghanistan, because it is going to lead, many critics now are fearing, to a brain drain. And all these educated Afghans, like interpreters and other educated Afghans, if they are leaving in thousands, what is going to be left behind to run the affairs, whether it's the current government or it's some kind of an inclusive government involving the Taliban in the future, which we don't see any signs of as of this moment. But such a large number of Afghans leaving the country, all of them educated, highly educated, obviously is not only causing problems for the Taliban's efforts to try to bring the country under their control and govern it and run it, but it is going to create problems even for the current government. So things are really not looking good for the country with this violence going on, bloodshed going on, this, unprecedented casualties being inflicted on Afghan civilians. And now we have this U.S. program encouraging so many people.
Ayaz Gul reports for VOA from Islamabad, Pakistan. Experts also say that Afghan women and children face a perilous future following the U.S. and NATO force withdrawal. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has that story.
When fighting rages between Afghan security forces and the Taliban, many caught in the crossfire are forced to flee their homes. Most of them are women and children. Five such families found refuge in this small house. Among them are three widows and many orphans with nowhere else to go and for whom school is no longer an option. Displaced widow Guldastav says she lost her husband and three sons to the fighting. She tells VOA her grandchildren now provide for the family as trash collectors in Kabul.
Look at these little kids. They're collecting paper and plastic from garbage. Is this work for little kids? What did Ashraf Ghani do for us? What did Karzai do? What did Taliban do for us? They widowed our girls. We've been here for months. No cooking, no meat, no good clothes or shoes. They're still trying to get medicine.
Earlier this month, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani gave Parliament a broad outline of a new plan to reach stability within 6 months. Many question whether the government has that long. Heather Barr is the interim co-director of the Women's Rights Division at Human Rights Watch.
It's been so alarming to watch the gains that the Taliban has made just in the last few weeks since the U.S. began this withdrawal. And it's been really distressing to sort of see the silence of the international community. This sort of disengagement and this sort of feeling like, too bad, shame, there's nothing we can do.
Human rights workers share a concern that the hands-off approach by the international community imperils a generation of women and children that had been mostly shielded from the Taliban. Mary Akrami is executive director of the Afghan Women Network in Kabul.
The Taliban still have same attitude, same behavior, same philosophy for their own self, like that they have their own war. And it's really not possible, it's really difficult for all people of Afghanistan, I'm sure, and particularly for women and the youth.
A displaced man identifying himself as M. Omar tells VOA his family just wants a normal life.
Taliban, you have mothers and sisters like us. The government, too. You have families and mothers and sisters. For God's sake, stop the fighting. For the sake of the Holy Book, stop the fighting. If there is no war, we can go home and work to provide for our families. We left everything behind.
These displaced Afghans say the Taliban set landmines around the homes they fled. They say their children lost limbs. They join the millions of Afghans displaced in and out of their home country. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. In the western U.S. state of California, its largest wildfire grew Wednesday. The development comes as thousands of firefighters prepare for a tougher fight as dangerous weather returns. While firefighters were able to save homes and hold a majority of the lines at the Dixie Fire, some flames did manage to jump and brought about an additional evacuation order for some 15,000 people. The largest western fire, which is the Bootleg Fire in Oregon, is now 84% contained, and firefighters are busy strengthening lines as they face the upcoming extreme weather. Turkey is also seeing one of its worst wildfires in decades, with at least 9 people killed as of Wednesday. Dorian Jones takes it from here.
When the more than 100 fires broke out last week over an area stretching more than 1,000 kilometers, Turkey only had 3 rented Russian firefighting aircraft. Turkey's fleet of about 12 firefighting planes is unfit to fly. The aircraft belong to the Turkish Aeronautical Association, set up by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who founded the Turkish secular state nearly a century ago. Critics accuse Turkey's Islamist-rooted government of deliberately running down the association, a charge the leadership denies. Pointing to a fleet of nearly 50 helicopters, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan insists there are adequate resources to fight the fires. In addition, Erdogan also said more firefighting airplanes from Russia had arrived, and Iran, Ukraine, and Azerbaijan were also sending aircraft. But offers of help from Israel and Greece have apparently not yet been accepted. More firefighting airplanes from abroad are expected. But for some in Turkey, it's likely to be a bittersweet sight, given many of the aircraft arriving are identical to Turkish planes that remain out of action. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Greek firefighters on Wednesday grappled with fires raising swaths of forest land on the outskirts of Athens. Thousands of residents have been evacuated from the region, and animals from tortoises to horses have been killed. Anthony Kirisava reports that experts are pressing for urgent measures, warning that the blaze may be a precursor of new, more destructive fires in the coming days.
The inferno has scorched the slopes of Parnitha, just north of Athens, in a protected nature reserve. It started in a wooden ravine and is the most devastating of the approximately 80 wildfires that have broken out across the country in recent days, including on the island of Rhodes, as temperatures top 45 degrees Celsius, the hottest day here, in 4 decades. Authorities say the blaze is partially under control, but firefighters remain on alert for fear of flare-ups fanned by light winds that have sent thick plumes of noxious smoke over the capital. Health officials are advising locals and tourists to avoid local travel and to wear protective masks, already in use during the pandemic, to block the inhalation of toxic particles floating in the air. Water-dropping planes, 9 helicopters, and dozens of water cannons have been used to battle the blaze. Soldiers, mountain rangers, and hundreds of volunteers have also joined in, helping evacuate locals and more than 100 horses from equestrian clubs scattered in the region. But the magnitude of the destruction has left this nation reeling. From early Wednesday, thousands of hectares of forest land were seen covered in gray ashes. The carcasses of burnt turtles, turkeys, deer, and horses lay scattered on the scorched land. Chicken coops were left charred, and herdsmen were seen early Wednesday counting their lost cattle in grazing lands across Parnitha. at least 80 homes have been razed. Greece's Homeland Security Chief Nikos Kardalias says Tuesday night was an exceptionally difficult night. He said the fire was under partial control on most sides, but there was still more work to be done. Two added forest fires remained out of control across the country, including on the island of Evia and the southern Peloponnese. Authorities on Rhodes have also elevated the island's fire risk situation, keeping the popular vacation destination in a state of heightened alert. Temperatures across the country have held at over 40 degrees Celsius for more than a week here, stretching emergency services and power demands. But scientists like Christos Zerefos warn that weather conditions could make the situation worse. With winds expected to whip up in the coming days, he said, Greece may see even severe fires, compounding the damage being wreaked by climate change. For Athens, Parnitha and its soaring pines have long helped offset the heat emitted by more than 2.5 million gas-guzzling cars in the capital. The intense heat has also placed a strain on Greece's power grid as people seek relief from the high temperatures. Antti Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
The World Health Organization says that more than 700 healthcare workers and patients were killed, more than 2,000 injured, and hundreds of health facilities destroyed in countries of conflict between 2018 and 2020. Lisa Schlein has those details.
A three-year analysis was carried out in 17 conflict-ridden countries and territories, including Ethiopia, Yemen, Syria, Mozambique, the occupied Palestinian territories, and Myanmar. New data show that healthcare continues to be under attack. So far this year, the World Health Organization has recorded 588 incidents in 14 countries with emergencies, causing 114 deaths and 278 injuries of healthcare workers and patients. The WHO's Director of Health Emergencies Interventions, Altaf Moussani, says the impact of those healthcare attacks goes well beyond claiming lives. He says the ramifications are significant and alarming, especially considering the ongoing COVID-19 response.
Their impact reverberates on healthcare workers' mental health and willingness to report to work, equally on communities' willingness to seek health care, and also drastically reduces resources for responding to a health crisis, amongst others.
Moussani says the ripple effect of a single incident is huge and has a long-lasting impact on the system at large. When health facilities are destroyed, he says, they need to be rebuilt. When healthcare workers are killed or wounded, he says a vital workforce must be reinforced. Building back those vital systems, he says, requires years of costly investment, years in which people in need are underserved.
During the pandemic, more than ever, healthcare workers must be protected, must be respected. Health hospitals and healthcare facilities, including the transportation of ambulances, should not be used for military purposes. Essential conditions for the continued delivery of vital healthcare must be given the necessary space.
Moussami notes any reduction in capacity will interrupt services and deprive vulnerable communities of urgent care. The WHO is calling on all parties in conflicts to ensure safe working spaces for the delivery of healthcare services. It says people caught in emergency situations must be able to safely access care free from violence, threat, or fear. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
WHO Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus is calling for a worldwide moratorium on COVID-19 booster shots until at least the end of September, which would allow low-income nations to get more initial vaccination doses.
We need an urgent reversal from the majority of vaccines going to high-income countries to the majority going to low-income countries.
Tedros says lower-income nations have vaccinated at a rate of about 1.5 doses per 100 people, while wealthier nations are vaccinating at a rate of nearly 100 per 100 people. He is also calling on the group of 20 economic powers, or the G20, who are meeting next month in Rome to make concrete commitments to support the WHO's global vaccination targets. U.S. government forecasters say that the Atlantic hurricane season is looking slightly busier than they first thought. Associated Press correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Forecasters at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration now expect 15 to 21 named storms, with 7 to 10 of them developing into hurricanes. The season got off to a busy start, with Elsa forming in July, the earliest named fifth storm on record. The lead forecaster at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, Matthew Rosencrans, says when storms develop in the Eastern Caribbean in June or July, as Elsa did, it tends to be a busy season. Since Elsa, however, the tropics have been mostly silent. Still, we're not yet at the peak of the season. That's mid-August to mid-October. I'm Ben Thomas.
This is Science in a Minute.
The Tyrannosaurus Rex, or T-Rex, is famous for being one of the most ferocious predators to ever walk the earth. Their name actually means Tyrant Lizard King. Did you ever wonder how many of these carnivorous dinosaurs existed? Charles Marshall, a paleontologist and professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and some of his colleagues gathered data and ran computer simulations to estimate the number of T-Rexes that stalked their prey in what is now North America. Writing in the Journal Science, Marshall and his team figured that about 20,000 of them lived on the continent at any one time, give or take 10%. They found that nearly 2.5 billion of them survived over 2.5 million years. T-Rex and all other non-avian dinosaurs were wiped out by the KT extinction event some 66 million years ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. Agency for International Development head Samantha Power met with officials in Ethiopia on Wednesday as the United States urges the government to allow clear access for humanitarian aid to the Tigray region. Earlier, I spoke with reporter Kebede Seyom, which is a pseudonym he uses out of safety concerns at Addis Ababa, about the visit.
Interestingly, the run-up to Samantha Power's visit has been more reported on and also more keenly watched by Ethiopians than her actual visit, which is still ongoing. But there has been little said about who she met. In fact, almost nothing said about who she met and where she went. I understand she also was planning to give a press conference to a select few media outlets, or at least a restricted pool of journalists. So the anticipation of her visit was more covered and more speculated and reported on, not only by state media, but by also netizens, or what you call, or people of Ethiopian origin living abroad, than her actual visit.
Right, and there's been very scant details about what she actually said in those meetings. At her press conference, she just said that dehumanizing rhetoric hardens tensions and can historically accompany ethnically motivated atrocities. Speaking about the aid that is slated to go to Tigray, what can you tell us about the current humanitarian situation in the region and the aid that is slated to go there?
It's almost entering to science month. Well, the UN is saying more than 5.2 million people are needed also emergency humanitarian aid. That includes food items and also medical supplies. Regarding how it is faring currently, there's a near total communication blackout. So the kind of information we're getting is from the UN bodies and others that seem to be giving less and less information on what the humanitarian situation is. Last month, there was a statement that said travel or access inside Tigray was getting better, while access or access issues from other parts of Ethiopia's Tigray was going in the reverse direction, difficult. Since then, there have been hiccups. But today, I think about 156 WFP trucks from which interconnect from the east. So there seems to be some movement, but not enough to meet the overwhelming humanitarian needs of the estimated 6 million people living in that region.
That was reporter Kebede Sayom in the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa. Back in June, Hong Kong officials shuttered a local museum that was dedicated to sharing the violent crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrations on June 4, 1989, in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. As reporter Ria Mogul tells me from Hong Kong, the museum is open once more. Well, kind of.
So back in June, when the museum was shut, it was shut because the government said that the museum was running under a faulty license. It had something to do with the food license that they were running under. Now, they've been running for years and years and years, and they've never had an issue. And it was this year that they had an issue. Now, of course, ever since the implementation of the national security law last year, Beijing has been clamping down quite hard on any form of dissent or, you know, freedom of expression, especially when it comes to very politically sensitive issues like the Tiananmen Square incident. So it was shut down, and the annual vigil, which is held every year to commemorate Tiananmen Square, was canceled due to COVID concerns. However, today we found out that the museum is reopening, but online. And it's reopening after a massive crowdfunding effort from people all over Hong Kong and of course, outside Hong Kong that still support the pro-democracy movement. And everything that was on physically in the museum is now going to appear online, you know, information to do with the Tiananmen Square incident, to do with the crackdown, the military crackdown in Beijing all of those years ago.
Yeah, Ria, I wanted to ask you about the fundraising effort, because the two people who chair the association that put together that annual vigil for June 4th have been arrested in the past. So what do we know about them and really the fundraising effort to reopen the museum online?
Yeah. So in fact, the chairperson of the alliance that runs the museum.
You mean Lee Chuk-yeon?
Yes. He was arrested over the 2019 protests inciting assembly. So he's currently serving time. So he's in jail. And the vice chairwoman, Chow Hang-tung, she was arrested on June 3rd, which was the eve of the June 4th anniversary this year. And she was charged with incitement to take part in an unauthorized assembly. Now, this crowdfunding effort, which has been going on, which has launched this new online museum, has been, and I believe, organized overseas after an assessment over the political risk. Now, ever since the national security law, activists, pro-democracy politicians, they've been very, very careful with what they do, just because there's been a massive crackdown on dissent and any sort of opposition in Hong Kong. A lot of activists have fled Hong Kong. A lot of them are in exile. And a lot of the pro-democracy camp are serving prison sentences at the minute. So, this effort is a surprise to many. A lot of people are commending it online because, you know, they see it as a positive thing to keep the spirit of Tiananmen Square going despite the harsh crackdown. So, people are seeing it as kind of like a light where there's one that, they probably need one at the minute more than ever.
Ria Mogul reports from Hong Kong, and the museum itself, well, can be viewed online at 8964museum.com. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.